Hi, people. Charlie Cooper here of the Radio First Term Iraq Show. Do not adjust your rabbit ears. The rabbit zone you're about to enter is brought to you in high definition Dave Rabbit Audio.
You're gonna be dead. Don't try to run, there ain't no place to hide, 'cause I got justice on my side. Not a double cross, think it's time you lost. You deserve everything you get. Well, I just told you he never been said. Well, can you see, or will you never know? Or are you moving way too slow? Not a double cross, think it's time you lost. You deserve everything you get.
Everybody, this is Dave Rabbit, and I have with me tonight an extremely VIP special guest, an actual hero of mine from a hero band of mine that dates back to the Radio First Termer show in Saigon, Vietnam back in 1971. I have with me the legendary Stevie Hill. Hi, Stevie. How you doing?
Hey, Dave.
You doing all right, brother?
This is the legend right here.
I mean, I can't tell you, you know, months ago when we first kind of hooked up via email, how much I've really been looking forward to this because,
good.
Boy, I mean, back in Nam when we were playing Blood Rock and introducing Blood Rock to the Vietnam troops and you guys became like a cult hero in Vietnam, it's amazing to find each other after all these years. I mean, we're talking like 35 years.
Right.
And then, you know, hook up. And, I mean, we're both Texas boys. You're Fort Worth. I'm Dallas. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of an interesting thing that we were that close to each other. But yet, when you're in Vietnam, you know, you seem kind of far apart.
That's true. And by the way, legend is your term, not mine.
I'm not reading script here. This is strictly, you're a legend, brother. I don't want to, you know, forget all this other guys. You know, I'm telling you, I got the Stevie Hill number one guy here.
Legendary is kind of a euphemism for other words.
for has-been over the hill.
But see, you read my mind.
Yeah, but I see, I don't mean it that way. See, I don't mean it that way. I mean, you know, your history, the band's history, the artists that comprise Blood Rock, I mean, you guys set the bar so high back then. I mean, it was just really amazing. Okay, let's get to it. How old were you, Stevie, that you could remember when you really got the music bug and said, you know, this is what I want to do with my life?
Probably 9 years old.
Okay, tell me about it.
I started taking piano lessons, and just something I was drawn to, and I kept studying probably for the next 10 years and doing piano recitals where it was all little girls and I was the only guy. And
which made it nice.
And I've had people say, well, man, it must be nice just to make money off of playing a keyboard. And sometimes I say, well, when did you start training for the job you've got?
What a great comeback. I love that.
I had a Studio 10 when I was 9, and so when all the other boys were basking in the Texas sun.
And boy, you and I can both relate to the Texas sun.
Right.
Before El Nino hit, you know, and all the weather went crazy.
That's right.
So were you like in high school band and all that other stuff?
I never did the band thing. It's kind of funny. I've been told that now, in like in a lot of the big high schools, that being in the band is really cool. It was when I was going to high school and junior high, that'd be like a good way to get beat up is to be in the band.
I can relate to that.
So I was kind of, well, I was, the other thing is I was trying to keep a low profile because, like, I was doing the sports thing for a while, and the coach, I just sort of dropped out one sport after the other because the coaches couldn't tolerate any hair that was longer than an inch.
So you really were emulating the rocker image even back in high school then, huh?
Oh, yeah. And, I was trying my best to be popular, but being in sports, sitting on the bench didn't exactly impress too many women. So,
yeah, and we both can flash back to how we were trying to impress women back in those days, too.
Still okay. Am, though.
Well, you're doing a better job of it than I am, brother.
Yeah.
I mean, at 58, you know, the only people I impress is, you know, my accountant. Okay, listen. I got. While we're on it, let's do a little sidebar here.
Okay.
So I graduated in '67 from high school, Richardson High School, there's a suburb of Dallas.
Right.
I can remember, Stevie, like when I was in junior high school at Stocker Junior High School. Yeah, Panthers. I can remember like '62, somewhere around there, hearing the Beatles for the first time,
right.
You know, on the radio. And I mean, it changed my whole life as far as wanting to be somewhere down the way, you know, a rocker, which I was up until high school.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my career stopped it after high school, but it just something that just really impacted me so much. Did you have anything like that along the way that just kind of you went, man, this is what I want to do?
Well, I did. Really, when I started out playing in the garage bands and all that, of course, I was playing in a lot of clubs that I was underage to be in. And but it was the hot thing was Stax Volt and James Brown and stuff like that. And to say if you're going to play a frat party or something like that, you really had to play all the big R&B hits. And then just overnight, they'd come up and say, "Do you know anything about Cream?" all the guys in the band was, "Now wait a minute, this is wow. We don't have to try to sound like we're black and butcher all these R&B songs." But there was probably at least 2 or 3 years where it was like half of your repertoire needed to be psychedelic music. And they couldn't dance to Toad or, stuff like that. But they still wanted to hear the R&B stuff. So it was it's kind of a weird time for garage bands.
Yeah, and, it really kind of changed over the years, I guess, too. All right, let me ask you this. All the guys from the original Blood Rock group, were they all obviously from Fort Worth, right?
Let me think about it. Yeah, we started out with 5 guys, and yes, they were all from Fort Worth.
Okay, so do you remember what year it was that you kind of loosely formed what would become Blood Rock?
Well, I think that I joined, Lee and I joined at the same time. I'm guessing that was maybe around 67. And what happened was Dean Parks, they used to be a 4-piece band, and Dean Parks, speaking of legendary, he is a legendary studio guitarist now that's played on a bunch of Steely Dan albums and stuff like that. And he decided he was going to quit the group and move out to L.A., so they had to hire 2 different musicians to replace him.
What was the band's name at that time? It wasn't Blood Rock, was it?
The Crowd Plus One.
The Crowd Plus One. Mm-hmm. In 1967, you join an existing group that is to become Blood Rock,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
All right, who are the members, the original members of the group?
Nick Taylor, Ed Grundy, Jim Rutledge, and Lee was in a different garage band at that time, and so Lee Pickens joined the same time I did.
Okay. When did you guys decide that you were going to choose a name, Blood Rock, and how did the name come about?
Well, most people, or what I've been hearing a lot of lately, was that Terry Knight came up with a name, so I'm going to go with that.
and after all these years, when you can't really remember what the facts are, whatever the urban legend is, just roll with it.
Exactly.
There's people that think Pat Sajak was really me,
Really?
And I'm going, hey, if I had Vanna White standing next to me, spinning the wheel, I might could work into that Pat Sajak syndrome. Yeah, it was really funny. I was at one time they thought I was a Baptist preacher and I was this and I was that. So I had to dispel that rumor that I wasn't Pat Sajak, but that was kind of funny. So, okay, you guys become Blood Rock. And then you start, obviously, like every band that was back in our era and bands today, I'm sure. You're playing local venues, local clubs in the Fort Worth area?
Exactly.
Okay, tell me what happens when Terry Knight, who was a producer from Grand Funk Railroad, sees you guys. Like, is he watching you perform at some kind of venue or something and comes up to you and says, "Say, guys, do I have a deal for you?" Or how does that transpire?
Well, what happened was we really didn't play that many clubs back then. It was like we were doing the private party thing, a lot of it. We would play in some clubs, but it was mainly for fraternities in Austin and Norman and all those good places. The night Terry came out was the weekend of the Texas Pop Festival, and he had Grand Funk booked on every festival you could think of during that summer. As the Texas Pop Festival, they were the first band all 3 days on that festival. And so that's why he was in town. And we were playing in Dallas for a fraternity party. And what we used to do, we'd just kind of mix in our team throughout the evening so we could be playing them live and kind of getting the feel for them.
Right.
And so when Terry showed up, we played, we took all our original tunes and put them together in one set. And Terry was very happy with it, but I think we were lucky to get out of there alive.
And so anyway, so Terry hears you and he goes, "Hey guys, listen, I think I can do something with you." Is that pretty much the way that kind of scenario rolls?
Well, not only did he say something like that, I would say probably within, he was a staff producer with Capitol. And I would say probably within 30 days that we were signed to a multi-album deal with Capitol.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when people sit there and say timing is everything, so timing obviously was everything for Blood Rock's history, because if Terry Knight's not there, you guys may be an independent artist like hundreds of thousands of independent artists are worldwide right now that are never going to have a contract simply because they didn't go to a certain place at a certain time and be heard by a certain person. That's pretty much it in the music world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Except,
wow.
Fortunately, it's a little bit different today because of the internet.
Yeah, the technology.
A lot more people have access to what you're doing. You can release your own albums and all that. It's a different challenge because what you're trying to do is, if you don't get up to the top of the search engines or on the first page, then you're just kind of lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, and you really are. You know, you guys have been compared, and in this interview, when we say you guys, we're going to be talking about Blood Rock as a group.
Right.
Not Stevie Hill as an individual artist, which we'll cover down the way.
Good.
But when you guys were kind of compared to Steppenwolf and Black Sabbath to a degree, when did you know, Stevie, that you guys had really made it? I mean, you obviously being signed by by Capitol was a huge step and all this other stuff, but you know, there's lots of people that are signed and, you know, their music, you know, goes down the toilet, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you guys really know that you really had made it, that you really were making an impact with your music?
Well, the way we knew that was we went from, say, playing at a frat party where they didn't recognize any of our songs and wanted to kill us for playing them to where people recognized our tunes. I think every artist is like that. You look out in the audience and all of a sudden people are singing along with
right.
your lyrics, and you figure out that your music is reaching out to more people than your relatives.
So really it's when you look out in the audience and people are not only digging the music, they're singing the lyrics, and that's when you really know you've made it, right?
I think the whole experience is a stair step thing.
Yeah.
So that's one level. There are just a lot of things that in entertainment look like you're getting rich and you're not. And then the things that people don't. Well, I'll give you a perfect example. Warren Zevon wrote the flip side to, I think, Three Dog Night's biggest hit. And when you write the flip side, at least back then, you get the same, all the money just split in half.
Right.
It's as though you wrote the hit side instead of the whatever side.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't know who he was back then, but he said that he bought his first house in L.A. off of that song.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not.
So, no, all right, let's do sidebar real quick. So, I mean, you and I both grew up in the 45 RPM days in the 78s.
Right.
So you're telling me that one artist may do a song that's on side A, which is the one that they're, you know, the DJs are playing and promoting and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be some other guy that writes the one on side B because you know, this particular artist, let's say, doesn't have two songs to put on each side.
Right.
So you're telling me that if that song goes number one, that just because you're on side B, you're getting just as much of the action?
Back then it was. Excuse me.
Wow.
I haven't written any hit songs lately, so I don't know how it's done now. But what's even better about that is that, well, the label, lots of times would want you to, as an artist, they'd want you to put like a weak song on the back, or what they thought was a weak song, because they didn't want the airplay split. I think the Beatles...
I think the Beatles are the only ones where that was really applicable.
Yeah, and I think
A and B
too.
Was good, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But the rule of thumb was, we don't want this other song being too strong, because then all of a sudden, it's sort of like the American Malady. You have too many choices. It would mess up the whole, just the record people, they need to keep it pretty simple.
I can attest to that. When we did our one song, and we never got even to one-hit wonder status, but, you know, when we did our song, Don't Take Your Love Away, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I mean, like, we started in the recording studio, like, at 7 a.m., and you can probably identify with these nightmare stories, like, at 7 p.m., let's say, and about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, after about the 100th take, when the guy was, you know, happy with what we had achieved, he said, okay, now we're going to do side B. And, of course, we had nothing for side B.
Right.
The song was written by some guy and just said, hey, here's a song. I want you guys to do it. Because we were doing the local venues in Dallas,
right,
you know, like you guys were in Fort Worth.
Right.
And so we said, we got nothing. He says, you got to have something. You got to have a side B. So our lead guitar player and our bass player just came up with some kind of just Mickey Mouse thing that sounded like it was from south of the border.
Yeah.
And it was called Midnight in Mexico. It's just a silly song, and we're so dead tired that we're going, yeehaw, yeehaw, you know, in the background and stuff. And it was just a silly, silly song. But, you know, I never really thought about it until you talked about it that, you know, other than the Beatles, I can't think of a single side B artist, and there probably is, and I don't want all these hundreds of emails going, Dave, you screwed up, you know, so-and-so. Led Zeppelin had a side B that was great, you know. You know, normally, other than the Beatles, I can't think of anybody really that had a side B that was really worth a flip.
Well, Elvis had the same problem.
Well, Elvis, yeah. See, there you go. The emails haven't even started coming towards me. Stevie, and you're already making me look bad by telling me Elvis. All right, well, speaking of the music, here we go. We introed tonight with the song Double Cross. Now, here's something interesting that you and I have not talked about. I know I told you about, you know, introducing you guys to Vietnam back in 71, etc. But every single show of the 21 shows that I did in Saigon started with Double Cross.
Oh, cool.
Every single show started with Double Cross.
Cool.
And the reason for it, and this is what's funny. I became a member a few months after I came out of the rabbit hole with a website called AboveTopSecret.com, which is kind of a conspiracy theory kind of website. And I've got to know all the owners real well and have a great relationship with them. One of the guys that were as a member there said, you know, he says, I always thought there was something strange about how you always started the shows with Double Cross. It's like maybe the government was really putting this show together, you know, and there was some kind of CIA conspiracy. I mean, on and on and on. And it was because of the word Double Cross. And in actuality, the reason why Blood Rock started every single show and the song Double Cross is because that's how I felt at the time, back being a youthful 22-year-old, that the troops had been double-crossed by the government trying to sell them this bill of goods. And that's really why I started that song, the intro song to all 21 shows. That's a true story.
That's pretty wild.
Tell me about Double Cross. I mean, who wrote the majority of the music that you guys did, Stevie? I mean, was it a collaboration of everybody, or were there specific people in the band that did the majority of the writing?
I would say two-thirds of our tunes were written by the guys in the band.
But was it the collaboration of all five or six of you, or was it just you and one other that did the majority? Because I would imagine being the keyboardist that, because of the piano background and stuff, isn't it easier for someone that has your background in music to come up with music and lyrics than it is? It was really funny. I interviewed one band, and the guy's a drummer. He says it's really tough writing songs when you're a drummer.
Right.
So I'm just curious, just, you know, as a sidebar here.
Well, it helps. It does help. However, there are zillions of, I don't know if James Taylor ever wrote anything on piano, but he's had a lot of hit records. So I don't know. I think it just depends on what your instrument is and what your talent is.
And what your inspiration is, obviously, to
right.
agree. In fact, somebody told me one time, one of the artists, the independent artists that I had done a show with, said that they had really done a lot of poetry as they were growing up, and a lot of rhyming and that kind of thing, or, you know, however the poets do it. And it really helped them when they were writing their songs, which I thought was kind of interesting. Tell me about Double Cross. How did the, is there some kind of significance to the song? How did you guys come up with the name of the song, and how was it kind of put together mainly?
Well, a friend of ours wrote the tune, Johnny Nitzinger. We used to see, he had a three-piece band, and we used to see him playing that tune, and so we thought it would be a good thing to adapt to the six-piece, at the time, I guess it was the five-piece lineup.
Right.
And we sort of did some arrangement on it, but the basic thing was Johnny.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in other words, you hear him play this song, and you say, hey, that may be something we can take on and do it in Blood Rock style, basically.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, Stevie, tell me about the song that we're going to hear next called Cheater.
That was written by I believe, four members of the band. I was one of them. It was just kind of a song that we jammed up in practice. It was always part of our live show. It's a song we enjoyed playing because it goes through kind of different movements. We liked playing it because it wasn't just your average whatever song.
I love the song. Does a name have any significance? Every band that I've ever interviewed, it's either about a lost love.
Yeah.
You know, or something. So Cheater, I mean, I can imagine that this could go, you know, really as an appropriate song for either male or female to be talking about whoever is on the other side of a relationship.
Right. Actually, I've read some different reviews where we got really slammed for that song, for the lyrics, which I thought were very good. But it's actually it's a positive song in terms of the lyric. I've read a couple of reviews where they said we wimped out and we're...
Oh, but you know, I tell you, you know, and I'm a sidebar here because, you know, this thing's going to go worldwide. You know, they're going to be, you know, just millions of people are going to hear this thing. This thing's going to live forever. You know, it's never going to go away, kind of like the common cold, if you will.
Right.
You know, I got to say this about music critics. It's fine to be a music critic, and it's fine to sit there and give your opinion about things. And the thing I've always hated about critics is there's always five or six guys that are the top critics.
Right.
And everybody hangs on every word they say, and it drives me absolutely nuts.
Right. Well, critics have to buy groceries too.
Well, yeah, and I understand it. But as long as they're fair, Stevie. about Breach of Lease? I thought that was an interesting title. So tell me about Breach of Lease.
Sure. And by the way, the thing about the critics, I did want to add this. Grand Funk was just brutalized by the critics, and so we would tour with them a lot, and whatever got said about us was multiply that by, you know, we thought we got off lucky because the critics just piled on those guys, and, you know, they had a really good in-person band, so anyway, somebody said we were terrible, and we were just going, wow, we're lucky.
Well, I got news for you. They were proven wrong over the years.
Oh, good. I hope so.
And I can attest to that, and so can millions of Vietnam veterans that were big fans of Blood Rock. Okay, so Breach of Lease.
Yes, Breach of Lease is another song we kind of jammed up in a rehearsal. Our buddy Johnny, actually, I think there are only two songs that we jammed up when he was at a rehearsal and wrote and helped us write. That was one of them, and I wrote part of it. So send the checks to my house.
StevieHill.com,
right.
As a matter of fact.
My address is on the website.
Yeah, we're gonna post that right now. www.StevieHill, that's StevieHill.com. Send those checks in.
Right. Thank you.
And, yeah, please be sure and leave the amount open so Stevie can just put whatever amount he wants to do.
Just send a dollar, okay, each of you.
Yeah, be sure it's dollars, not cents.
How many listeners did you say you had?
We have a base of 2 million, but this will be heard by up to 35 million folks because of the people that pick up my feeds, and then they put it out over there, like iTunes will pick it up, Podcast Pickle, Digital Media. I mean, there's just a bunch of them worldwide that will pick up my feeds, and then they'll distribute it through their feeds. And, you know, the thing about the Internet is every computer is connected, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, it's accessible by just people all over the world. I mean, I have fans in every single country, even communist countries.
Right.
And then they, you know, in turn, they'll pass on the website and they'll do this and do that. And by the time it's all said and done, you know, I mean, it's just you're talking about reaching millions of people with not only the music of Blood Rock, which dates back to the 70s, but Stevie Hill himself, which is what I really want to try to promote tonight.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. I want to take a sidebar here, Stevie, and that is, I know Warren Hamm replaced the lead singer,
right.
Jim, right?
Yes.
Okay, I saw something that was written that said something about during the Warren Hamm era that the band often refused to play their earlier songs with satanic or cynical themes such as Whiskey Vengeance and DOA, which DOA, I have to say right now, DOA was the number one hit in Vietnam.
That's good.
And the reason for that is that everybody identified, even though it wasn't airplane crashes, but everybody identified with that finality.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what really made Blood Rock really number one. So, okay, back to what I was saying, the Warren Hamm era. So you're on a stage and somebody's out there in the audience going, play DOA. So, I mean, is Warren saying, no, we're not going to play those satanic songs? Or tell me what went on when it happened.
Okay, well, the deal with that, first of all, it's been distorted a little bit because it's not like we went for a year like that. I think we went for about 4 weeks. And and it wasn't just Warren. We just kind of made a group decision. We had a lot of new material. We had already done Passage. We just thought that we were going to be brave and just try to establish a new identity. But after the night where they booed us incessantly, we decided maybe that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah, it brought your memories back real quick about what got you successful, right?
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, we were in our early 20s then, so we didn't know anything about show business. We just kind of figured we called the shots.
Yeah, boy, that brought reality real bad.
Yeah, exactly. Your booking price, too.
child out on the wall. All the gods are now preparing for the feast that waits us all. We'll be right back.
Gotta Find a Way. Tell me about Gotta Find a Way.
Yeah, I think that was like one of the first songs we wrote together. I think all the guys in the band are on the writer's credits for it, and it was sort of an excuse for us to play a whole bunch of solos. But it was another song that we played at just about every show, so the crowd liked it, and like I say, we killed a lot of time during the set with that one song.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the three songs that I played the most in the 21 shows that we did was Double Cross, Gotta Find a Way, and of course DOA. We just really played them a lot during the 21 show run. You know, I read something interesting. I never really got to thinking about it until I really just started really concentrating on it. And I did this just to see if it was right or not. Hidden message. This is true, folks. So if you have the technology to run something backwards, you're going to have a kick out of this. The song Gotta Find a Way contains one of the earliest instances, and I'm quoting, of hidden messages. Near the beginning of the song, the following message is played backwards. And this is, and I quote, this is on the song if you play it backwards. Anyone who is stupid enough to play this record backwards deserves what he is about to hear. Yeah. And then right after that is somebody reciting the poem Jabberwocky.
Right.
Whose idea was to do this? I thought this was hilarious.
Well, thanks. I'm not going to take credit for the whoever's listening, that part of it. We're in the studio, and we're just experimenting around, and we said, what if we put something on during that solo that was backwards? So, yeah, let's do it. And Jim says, that's great. What do I say? What should I say? And, you know, he had ideas too, but I suggested recite some of that. And so we ran it backwards, and it wasn't long enough. It was just like I think all I could remember was the first verse of it. And it wasn't long enough, so he's like, we got to put something else on there. And so, I don't know, make up something. And so that was the kind of mean-spirited other part of it.
When I read that, I thought, you know, God, you know, of course, you know, with digital technology that we have nowadays, I mean, it's real easy to sit there and, you know, play stuff backwards or whatever, you know, and I'm sitting there going, God, this is too cool. You know, I guess I did it about 19 times, you know,
right.
I just kept laughing my ass off because, you know, I mean, who would thought back in the 70s that someone would have, you know, come up with this idea? I mean, I thought it was just absolutely outstanding.
Thank you.
It was just absolutely outstanding.
We put it backwards because we didn't want people to think we're too literary.
It was greatness. It was absolute greatness.
Good.
I gotta find a way. creek bed, your girl standing by your side. She feels the same as it's best to do, that you're gonna let it ride. You tell her how you feel about the birdies and the bees. You're standing by the lonely tree and you get you on your knees. I gotta find a way to understand. You're sleeping all night just to get up and do it again. You take your pay and you rest one day and you never reach the end. I gotta find a way to understand. Understand.
All right, Stevie, I want to talk about something on a little bit more serious note, and I don't want to get heavy into it. You're in the process, if that's the right word, that you're fighting leukemia.
Right.
How long ago were you diagnosed?
I would say 5 years ago, five or six years ago.
So the doctor says, Stevie, I have bad news for you. You have leukemia. Tell me what's going through your mind, because you know, at your age, I mean, we're about the same age.
Yeah.
But you know, you're starting to really get into your own as an independent artist and really starting to really flourish. And you know, you're still getting all the accolades from, you know, your prior artistry that you had with Blood Rock.
Right.
And different bands that you were in. And the guy comes in and says, Stevie, I'm sorry to tell you, you got leukemia. I mean, this has got to just wipe you out, doesn't it?
Actually, it didn't, because the guy didn't know what he's talking about. He like the he was right about the leukemia part, but then he gave me a bunch of happy talk about.
Forgive me for laughing, Stevie, but you're making you're giving me a comeback that's just blowing me away. You know, I'm thinking we're gonna have this kind of this little serious moment, and you're telling me the guy was wrong.
Well, it wasn't the first time either. Anyway.
So tell me what's really going on with this thing, because I'm reading all kinds of really, you know, I mean, like they're getting ready to do taps and all this other stuff, and you know, obviously that's not the case.
It just I don't know, because I was living in Dallas at the time, and all these people were kind of giving me a lot of happy talk about it. I went to Parkland, and they were kind of the same way, and they said like your white cell count is only 200,000, and I think the normal is 9,000. But we're just going to wait.
Wow.
And we're just going to pay attention. And then when I came over to Fort Worth and went to the doctor over here, she said, you're going to the hospital right now.
Oh, God.
She was like, no, we don't do it that way. We don't wait till it gets to 200,000. So the good news is, because when the doctor said, well, it looks like you have leukemia. And yeah, I was thinking, I've heard of that. That's something that you die from. So,
well,
I think I would be out of the woods by now, but the woods turned out to be a lot bigger than what I thought they were. And the guys in Dallas did. The guys in Dallas didn't think there was a woods.
But, you know, Stevie, your attitude, you know, when we privately emailed each other and I said, you know, Stevie, I want to maybe touch on this, because you really have become an inspiration. People that know you, people that are around you, people that are friends of yours, and you know, obviously I hope I'm included in that small cluster of group. But, I mean, people that, you know, have been a fan or have been just a supporter of you, everybody obviously is just rallying around you on
good.
This kind of thing, and you've really given, I said it in my email, I said, you know, Stevie, I think you could really be an inspiration to people that, I mean, your attitude, Stevie, I gotta tell you, I mean, you know, we've talked briefly one other time, I'm telling you, your attitude is kick-ass. I mean, it really is, and I mean, it's such a breath of fresh air to talk to somebody of your stature.
Thanks.
And have the things going on that you got going on in your personal life, and you're sitting there laughing about mm-hmm. these stupid doctors, you know, talking about the white cell count.
Right.
Because, they, you know, I hope they're not counting those individually now, Stevie.
Counting
I mean, what? I hope they have some kind of computer that counts all that stuff. So, you know, instead they got some, you know, guy they're paying a buck and a half that, you know, was an assistant at McDonald's,
yeah.
you know, back there counting and giving you some false information. But really, you know, you've just got such a tremendous attitude, Stevie. I mean, you know, my thoughts and prayers, and I know everybody else is with you day and night, my brother.
Well, thanks. It's refreshing to hear that. Most of my career I've been trying to be a bad influence on people, so I'm glad to hear it's turning around a little bit.
Yeah, after 35 years, see, I thought the same thing. They're going, oh, that damn Dave Rabbit's coming back out of that rabbit hole. We're going to figure something to do with that guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I had that same kind of thing. Oh, and, you know, I mean, I don't care what you do, Stevie, in your life. I mean, you know, you have to be proud of what you do. I'm proud of everything I've ever done that, can, you know, has to do with Radio First Termer, Radio First Termer Iraq, and also, you know, the Dave Rabbit persona.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevie Hill has not a thing ever that I have ever seen, heard, or read about that has anything to do but be proud of everything that you've accomplished. And I'm proud to call you my friend.
Well, thanks. I've tried to quash all the other stuff or either pay those people off.
And you've done a very good job, as have I. Okay,
that's
tell me about
damage control. That's not
controlling.
Like
inspirational. Yeah, or you know, a nuclear strike, you know, to avoid anything.
They used to think Michael Jackson was a good guy too, but
oh Christ! Now you got us, you know, in bed with Michael. Nice going, Stevie.
I didn't say anything bad about him. I said they used to think that.
Well, I'm not saying anything bad, but now you've got it. You know, everybody thinking, well, is Stevie really comparing Michael Jackson to Dave and him? You know? Tell me about Lucky in the Morning.
Another song that Johnny Nitzinger wrote, and I mean, it was pretty big sounding already when he was playing it. We just kind of did our thing to it, and just depending on who you talk to, who's taking credit for it being a hit. It was another song that we played. It was in our set. We would be playing. We did a lot of opening shows, so the set was 45 minutes long. And
right.
All these songs you're talking about were in the short set as well as the long set.
Well, I intentionally selected songs, just so you'll know, that I personally like a lot, even though I saw that there were some songs, for instance, like Melvin Laid an Egg, and a couple of others that, you know, people said, well, that were fans' favorites. But, you know, the ones that we're showcasing are the ones, at least the ones that were already out by the time I did the Saigon show in 71.
Right.
Didn't 2 come out in 1970, Blood Rock 2?
Probably.
And then 3 came out, what, like in 72, I think, or something like that, didn't it? Maybe 73?
Probably.
A couple of years apart?
Well, at one time we had 3 albums on the charts, and so I know they must have been released probably like within a year of... Here's the deal. The label, I mean, they just wanted you to... They wanted as many albums out of you as possible in the shortest
exactly.
period of time. Terry Knight, that's what he wanted too. We just did a lot of recording in that first couple of years.
Well, the recordings that you did were just, you know, in, like I said before, magnificent. And that's why Blood Rock's always been my favorite all time. Now they call it classic rock.
Yeah.
But I'm going, classic rock, geez, you know, I grew up with this stuff. But I mean, you know, Blood Rock has always been my number one band. And number two is James Gang, just so if anybody says, well, I wonder who Dave's number two band is. James Gang. And then some of the biggie ones come on down the way, you know, Led Zeppelin and Hendrix and all those guys.
Right.
But Blood Rock has always been number one, and I'll tell you why, just from the standpoint of just the uniqueness of the songs, Stevie.
Cool.
I mean, the uniqueness of the songs is just, I think you can compare any of the ones that we're playing tonight with any of the majors, and they are just as equal or better than ones that, you know, bands that, for instance, maybe have been more popular or had a better financial success. I think Blood Rock is just right there with all of them,
oh,
personally.
Thanks.
Touch it.
Okay, we're going to move into the final song, but before we get into DOA, and I want you to tell me about DOA in a second, I've got a little surprise for you.
Okay.
And that is, when we right before we played DOA, remember I sent you, a month or two ago, I can't remember, I went back to the 1971 existing show and just excerpted about maybe 4 or 5 minutes of the original Saigon show that had the Blood Rock cuts in it. And, of course, it was the entrance to the show itself with Double Cross. And then I think we had got to find a way in there. And, of course, DOA, which I love DOA because I got to do my famous impression of They're Coming to Take Me Away Again. And I sent that to you. So as a kind of a surprise, kind of an extra added attraction for all your fans and for the Dave Rabbit fans, I'm going to insert that before we listen to DOA, kind of as a tribute, if you will, to all the band members that were involved in Blood Rock. But before we go into DOA, I'm going to ask you one other thing. And this is back, and I forgot to really talk about it, but March 12th, 2005, you get together all the band members, or somebody gets together all the band members to do a reunion show
right. In
Fort Worth to benefit leukemia and the awareness of the disease itself. This had to be an extremely emotional experience for you to, and I don't know if you had seen the guys over the years or whatever, but I know when we had a band reunion for my band, I mean, we were nothing compared to you guys. You know, it was a very emotional experience for me to see guys that I hadn't seen in, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever. So tell me about the reunion concert that was done in Fort Worth.
Let's see. Where do I start on this one?
Anywhere you want. It's your show.
Well, first of all, we thought we were going to have a good turnout, or, you know, at least an okay turnout. We sold out the hall. It was at the Ridgely Theater.
Right. And I know where that is.
Yeah. And I don't know, it was a lot of fun. We had some rehearsals to get ready for the thing, and it was a blast, really. Some people were talking about us doing some more dates. One thing we had going for us in that concert was just everywhere you look, there were people that were donating things and trying to take care of the overhead
right. So
that, you know, half the money wouldn't be going to expenses.
Exactly.
And so I learned a lot from that show, and especially just the idea that it'll surprise you how many people will just show up out of nowhere and donate a lot of time and whatever, their equipment. It's amazing.
Had you seen the band members, the band members that came to the reunion? I know you said like 5 out of 6, I think, made it. Had you seen them previously on social occasions or whatever, or had you all kind of remained out of contact? Or?
Well, I would say we had all kept in touch and sort of knew what was going on with each other. Ed Grundy, he did most of the legwork as far as putting the thing together and organizing it. He and I have stayed in touch over the years, and like most of the live gigs that I've played that were where I was the band leader, I used Ed on bass. So it wasn't like your high school reunion from 40 years ago or anything.
And we've both been to those. Let's do a sidebar real quick. Have you gone back to any of the reunions and people know who Stevie Hill is?
Yes, I have. And there's a group, fortunately, with Richland High School, there's a group of people that do a good job of kind of a core group that keep in touch with each other. John Dillon also, he and I were in the same class at Richland, and I don't know, a lot of he attracts a lot more attention than I do usually. Not because of John, because John's just he's a pretty quiet guy normally, but they're usually a lot more interested in what John's doing than what I'm doing, so, and that's fine too.
All right, let's roll into the last song, which is DOA. Tell me about DOA.
All right, DOA was another product of a rehearsal where we just jammed it up from scratch. Lee and I were doing a little, it started off with the two-note motif where we're imitating the European sirens. And it was kind of just built around that idea that it was based on the sirens sort of led to. And I think Jim and Rick wrote most of the words. Well, we all just said, well, what if we make something really gory and sensational? And so we did that, and I threw in a few chords here and there. I'll be honest about it.
Well, you know what's really amazing? You know what's really amazing, Stevie, is that, you know, I told you it became the number one song by GIs on the front lines in Southeast Asia. And I think the lyrics, you know, I mean, the lyrics are kind of, you know, kind of moody and kind of gory and kind of whatever. But, you know, that really got to be the mentality of the frontline troop, because they really didn't know from one moment to the next if they were going to live or die.
Exactly.
And the lyrics to the song and the music and the mood of the music and, as you say, the sirens in the background or whatever, I mean, it really was an audio version of what each troop mentally went through on a day-to-day basis in the, you know, the rice paddies of Vietnam. Well, and I think that's one reason why Blood Rock became such an outstanding, popular group in Vietnam. You know, you and I talked about this months ago, and I told you, you know, because you said, yeah, I had heard, you know, that we were real popular in Vietnam, and that was the reason, was because of the Radio First Terminal show. Because, you know, AFVN, they would have never played Blood Rock.
I believe it.
I mean, those guys.
I don't know how many times,
you know,
I've heard that.
Oh man, you know, they were so straight. It was, you know, I mean, it was amazing how straight those guys were. Adrian Cronauer, I mean, they would have never played Blood Rock or anything like that. I think that's one of the reasons why you guys really, back in those days, really became what they called a cult group.
Mm-hmm.
I think you really did become a cult group to a degree, don't you think?
When you say cult, does that mean you don't have very many fans?
No. No, it doesn't mean that, Stevie.
Okay.
No, what I mean by cult group is, I mean, I've had so many people as example when they would hear Blood Rock for the first time. Like I featured you guys as a classic rock group back on episode 3. I even had to look it up because I wanted to be sure I got the right episode right. When I was doing the PodSafe Music Artist, each particular rock show that I would showcase 6 bands, I would put, you know, one of the classic rock groups. And you guys were like on episode 3. And I got literally several hundred messages and emails about, God, we had never heard Blood Rock before. And I'm talking about, this is a new age group.
Yeah,
you know,
cool.
I'm not talking about our group.
Right.
You know? I'm talking about people that had never heard Blood Rock. And they thought, you know, God, these guys are really great. It just goes to show that what you guys accomplished back then really stood the test of time. I mean, it really did, Stevie.
Well, good.
Well, listen, I know that you have just been so generous with your time. You know, I can't wait to do our next show, which is going to be down the way when you get ready to do it. And we're going to showcase Stevie Hill as an independent individual artist. And I'm excited about that opportunity. And we're going to talk about that down the way, Stevie. You
good.
And we know each other's numbers. So whenever you're ready to do the Stevie Hill show,
yeah,
not to be confused with Benny Hill,
yeah,
but Stevie Hill show, then we're going to do that. But I want to remind everybody about Stevie's website. It's www.steviehill, that's STEVIEHILL.com.
Right.
And Stevie, I can't thank you enough. I want you to hold on because I want to talk to you off air.
Well, one more thing. I want to talk to all the military people out there.
Do it.
I want all you people, men and women, just to come home safe.
And I don't think we could say it any better than that, Stevie.
Okay, good.
Well, before we roll with the special feature of the Radio First Termer Saigon show insert, I want to remind everybody that the following excerpt is rated R. It contains explicit military language, and I want to caution you that you are going to hear several F-bombs during this little sequence before the ending song of DOA. So on behalf of Stevie Hill and Dave Rabbit, just remember, you don't have to support a war to support the troops. Peace, everybody.
The following program is in living color and has been rated X by the Vietnam Academy of Magic. This is Radio First Terminal, operating on Dave Rabbit's own frequency at 69 megacycles on your FM dial. The purpose of this program is to bring vital news, information, and hard acid rock music to the first terminals and non-reentry students in the Republic of Vietnam. Radio First Turner operates under no Air Force regulations or manuals. In the event of a vice flood raid, this program will automatically self-destruct. Your host tonight, Dave Rabbit.
And this is Dave Rabbit, along with my studio engineer, Pete Sadler, bringing you tonight hard acid rock music to blow your mind with. Red Rock 2, Devil's Cross. Cooking from the Big 69. Blood Rock 2, Double Cross. Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host for the next 3 hours of hard acid rock music, Dave Rabbit, and my studio engineer, Pete Sadler. For those of you who have just recently come into the Republic of Vietnam, I'd like to give you a little information about it so your mind won't be quite so blown when you hear such words as fuck and words of that nature. We're an underground radio station here, and we say what we feel like saying, and we bring the truth to the first termers in the Republic of Vietnam. We also bring you hard acid rock music all through the night, the up-to-date music of today's American youth. Carlos Santana, Evil Ways, they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, to the funny farm, the life is happy all the time, and everyone goes 69, Blood Rock. From the gigantic 69, Vietnam's only psychedelic FM stereo multiplex station, James Gang, STOP, which can mean stop or state tax on pussy.
Nugent?
Finally in the news, Lyndon Johnson was arrested in his Texas home for indecent public exposure after he led a group of Vietnam protesters down Main Street. Johnson was also cited on 10 counts of public vulgarity and one count for shooting the finger at an Air Force officer. Preliminary hearing dates have not been set yet. Dave?
And that's the news. This is Air Force Sergeant Dave Rabbit.
And Nugent.
Wishing you a very good evening.
The voice of news, information, and hard acid rock music. This is Radio First Termer at 69 megacycles on your FM dial.
Continuing on now, Blood Rock. Gotta find a way. What they're really trying to say is, I've gotta find a way to get out of fucking Vietnam.
Stare. Just experienced Dave Rabbit and the Rabbit Zone. For more fun, audio, and video, visit Dave's official podcast home at www.daverabbit.podomatic.com. Until next time, this is Nadira. Peace.